Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Pop Culture Quorum Deo podcast. My name is Jeff Wright. I'm one of your regular hosts, and I'm here with Jared Moore. Jared, as always, how you doing today, man?
Doing well, man. Doing well. Had good. A pretty good day. It's Wednesday evening. Had a good time at church.
Yes. So it is Wednesday evening when we're recording this. Now, we will release a little bit later than that, but today's an important day, not just because we had church service, Jared. Do you know whose birthday it is today?
Abraham Lincoln.
It may be. I don't actually know if that's true or false, but think major pop culture artifact. Think blue and red. Think wears his underwear on the outside.
Superman
turned 80 years old today. He was created by Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, and the world met him April 18th, 1938, in Action Comics number one.
I wish I had that copy.
I wish you did, too. It'd be fun to know a very wealthy person.
For real.
And I just,
it'd be fun to know.
I just rejoice in my friends receiving blessing, right? It's because of how godly I am. I don't know if you've noticed that, but that's why.
Yeah, I've noticed, man. You're like, I don't know, it's like Moses coming down from the mount with having to wear a veil.
Okay. It's getting a little thick here. Listeners, get your waders on. Hey, look, we're reviewing today Justice League from 2017. I mentioned a couple episodes back that we were looking to do some Redbox content that would be available to people who are bringing stuff home to watch with their family or bring home to watch in their leisure time. Justice League has been at Redbox for several months now, and all cards on the table. Jared was kind enough to review this film with me as basically a personal favor. Very specifically, I feel like this movie has gotten a bad rap. So it got panned by critics when it came out. Right now on Rotten Tomatoes, it's got a 40% score among professional movie critics. And that's pretty indicative of the way critics responded to this movie. They saw it as choppy, uneven. Anyway, they raked it over the coals pretty hard. And I'm going to say on this podcast that this movie deserves another look and reconsideration. Now, I say that, though, with a particular caveat. I think this movie deserves another look and reconsideration if your conscience will allow you to watch the movie. And so with that in mind, Jared, what conscience issues do you see in Justice League?
There are a few cuss words. The Lord's name is abused a few times, and there are a few scantily clad outfits for both men and women, and there's a lot of violence and some scary, intense scenes.
Yeah, there is a time where we go to Wonder Woman's home island, Themyscira, and just like Wonder Woman doesn't wear, particularly, I don't know the right description, her clothing doesn't cover her body extensively. That is true for her neighbors and relatives there on Themyscira. And so, the physical form is put on display pretty quickly and pretty thoroughly. No nudity, of course, but nudity is probably not the standard we're looking for when we think about modesty and the needs of Christians to present themselves appropriately, right?
Mm-hmm.
Super violent, too. I mean, this movie, it's a superhero movie. There's fights, people die, horses get killed, women get killed riding horses. Yeah, just violence everywhere. Before we jump into analysis proper, I had mentioned previously that this movie had been raked over the coal by the critics, and it's not just critics, it's also comic book fans in general who have given Justice League a very hard time. In order to get an accurate representation of that perspective on our show here, I've called in the help of a special guest. Okay, guys, I am here with the Calvinist Batman. You may know him from his own podcast by that name, Calvinist Batman and Friends, or maybe you've met him through the Theology League. Either way, I met him in person at a recent conference, and he gave me a book by Trevin Wax called Eschatological Discipleship, since books are my love language. I sort of developed a Wookiee life debt toward him in terms of feeling like I needed to connect with him more. So he was kind enough when I reached out and said, hey, we're covering Justice League. Would you be willing to give your thoughts on that, since Calvinist Batman clearly has an interest in theology and superheroes? And he was kind enough to say yes to that. And so, sort of conversing through Twitter, I found out that he has a critical take on Justice League. And since the theme of our episode is the need for people to take a second look at this movie and maybe reevaluate some of those criticisms, I thought it would be a perfect opportunity for Calvinist Batman to represent that critical take. So that's what I'm going to ask him to do here. Calvinist Batman, thanks for being on. on, man. I appreciate you taking the time to do this.
No problem, Jeff.
Great Batman voice. Okay, so if I were going to say to you, look, I want you to go full bore on what's wrong with Justice League. And I said, what is the central problem with Justice League? How would you answer that question?
To boil it down, I would say that the central problem of Justice League is that they are not the heroes anyone ever has ever seen, ever. So when you come to a superhero movie, there's a expectation that at least you will take something or a good part of the character's history, character and backstory and development in particular, and all of this will make its way somehow into screen. Even if it's, where you're pulling from their very beginnings, where they're not the person we kind of know them today, but at least that's in the catalog there. At least we're expecting that. And every single character in this movie there's no one going, yeah, that's who I grew up. Or that's who I read. They are Batman isn't Batman. If we're going to focus on who the central character of Justice League, of course, is. So Batman's not Batman in the movie because he does nothing or believes nothing or acts in no way like any Batman has ever acted or believed or preached at people. And so those things are critical. And if you take away all the superhero facade and just look at it as a movie, it's really horrible. The only thing that makes it even passable is the fan reaction to seeing their superheroes on screen, or people at least knowing about these heroes. And seeing them on the screen. And even then, it's still a horrible movie.
Well, you're certainly not wrong there. It is so jarring watching that movie, seeing Batman.
I watched it again just for the show.
You did.
More than a life debt.
Yes, and thank you for that. If you guys want to go see that, that is a fun Twitter read. I think the hashtag was Justice League.
LT.
LT. Okay, so Justice League LT. Look for the hashtag on Twitter. You can read along with that. It's so jarring to watch a Batman cast around for someone to lead the team, as if Batman's not the default leader in every room he walks into.
Yeah. The more of my problems were, I mean, this movie has serious baggage as it is, sure, coming from Batman versus Superman, Dawn of Justice, and Man of Steel even. Someone said recently that ever since DC Warner Brothers, I guess, has entered into trying to make a shared universe for DC, for their cinematic universe, everything's been horrible. Mm. Outside of two-thirds of Wonder Woman, everything's been horrible. That their best moments were actually when no one had a shared universe. It was just Batman or just Superman. And I thought they did some great work, and I agree. So I totally lost my train of thought.
Well, while you're regathering it, can I ask you, what are your thoughts on Zack Snyder as a creative mind, kind of shepherding the whole thing?
Well, he's creative in that he likes three things. And three things only: slow motion, a lot of CG, like effects and backgrounds, and in my opinion, exploiting women. Mm. So every movie has, they're just skanks. Like, that's just what he's known for. So as much as he tries to do things supposedly that are empowering, I think the only movie so far in the DCCU that he has not directed is Wonder Woman. And maybe that's praise for why it did so good, besides that, almost all of it is directed, written, acted by women. The most powerful piece for women didn't come from Zack Snyder, mm-hmm. Who's been the kind of spearhead and brainchild of Kevin Feige for DC. It's come from just a woman and a few writers.
Sure. Do you buy my theory? And I know this is coming at you cold, but my theory is he adapted Watchmen and he's never been able to get that paradigm of like dystopian, looking at the seedy underbelly of superhero culture out of his head. So when he sees, Superman, he's seeing Dr. Manhattan. When he's seeing Batman, he's seeing Rorschach. He just can't break through from Alan Moore's vision. Does that make sense?
It does. I'm not sure if some of your listeners are going to praise me for this or criticize me for this, but I have yet to see the movie that he made.
Sure.
Mostly because up until recently, I had not read Watchmen. And that moment right there is a boo I should have. And a yay that the first, kind of introduction of Watchmen that I ever had was not the movie. Because as much as he tries to stick, I've heard by the book, the design schemes of the book are the book. So Watchmen is more than the words and the visual story, the artwork.
Sure.
It's what was in the mind of the artist in particular, not the writer, the artist, when they were drawing Watchmen. Because I personally think it should be studied in universities. It's a masterful piece of work that DC actually is doing a okay job doing a sequel to, but they're missing it. It can't fit in their shared universe and be as great. The color palette, Zack Snyder loves muted colors. He has a fascination for them. Every movie, if you watch every movie he's ever done, every single movie has muted colors in it. So everything's kind of like grayscale with blue in it. Or sure. if you're in 300, it's grayscale with red in it. But Watchmen is very bold and striking and neonish at many points. I think I'm going way deep into Watchmen here, so sorry.
I'm the one who asked, man. I appreciate it.
I think Zach loves art and loves comics. I truly do. Watching him and Kevin, I cannot remember his name right now, but he's a big comic book guru and huge fan. All the work they were doing when Batman v Superman was in production. You watch them together and they're like, this is the movie for the fans. And but you can love something and not know how to adapt it.
Yeah.
You can love something and not know how to make a great movie. And you can make it pretty. I mean, I would argue that the computer effects department probably covers up a lot of what is already wrong with the movie.
Justice League at this point, right? That
I'm probably talking about every one of those movies.
Gotcha.
If it was just done on pure what is being caught in camera, there'd be nothing there. Maybe the actor, like 20% of the time. But most of it is in the computer. And so all we know is that he knows people who can make great movies on a computer or great visual looking movies, except for this one on a computer, you know?
Yeah. So I think that's a pretty good dovetail back to an earlier point I was going to ask you to explore just a little bit. You said none of these characters are the characters we've known from this long-running comic book and other property continuity we have. Could you just flesh that out for us just a little bit for the characters who make up the Justice League?
Absolutely. So the one I pointed to mostly in my kind of live tweet was The Flash, because that's the one that is newest to the the viewer in this. I mean, we get a little bit of Cyborg, but we've seen a video of him. We've barely seen a video of this guy since he's super fast. And so we catch him, and looking at the long history of Barry Allen and what he does, there's some nice plays. So we see the dad in jail, but the character himself is this scrawny weakling who is just eaten up with fear and anxiety, who has not a hero bone in his life yet. That is not a story that's found anywhere in the pages. He's been scared, don't get me wrong. But that kind of character is not who anyone remembers as Barry Allen. Barry Allen always has had a sense of justice about him. I mean, most comic books place him as in the criminal detective kind of field. Like, that's who he is. He's not, and this time now, I guess he's a computer something. We don't really know
right
what he's been doing all this time. But I guess he does websites, as best I can guess. It's a really fancy rig for websites, but and by the time he ends the movie, he's in the crime lab. So you can argue, well, maybe this is a prequel to literally everything that he's gone through. But I don't see how his next movie is supposed to be Flashpoint. Like, if it gets developed. Exactly. I'm not going to get off on that. But Flashpoint holds, especially as a story source, the whole reason why it's such a heartbreak. It's not it's a heartbreak tale, because Barry has always had the sense of justice. We move on from what tries to destroy us, and we let it build into our character, and we improve from it. We learn from it. Just because I can fix the past doesn't mean I should. Mm-hmm. And in Flashpoint, he does. And that's why it's so heartbreaking, because he gets what he finally wants, only to see that everything else has been messed up in regards. And it's like a definite, that moment is probably, I would between this and Crisis of Infinite Earths, is the defining moment in the entire DC universe. I think, for in the comics. Like right now, what DC is doing in their comics is hearkening back 20 years to this story.
Sure.
So it's like it's a pivotal piece anyway. But there's no way the kid we know now is going to make that movie.
Yeah, there's not enough time to develop him into the person, right?
There's 10 years here. So if you argue a prequel, then you are arguing already for the demise of its sequel, at least for what we as the fans know. And what when we hear, hey, there's Flashpoint, we go, oh, I would love to see a perfect rendition of that. And you say, sure, that's what we're going to give you. And you don't even understand the character. I'll make one more reference. So Batman, I started the hashtag not my Batman because not only does this Batman not out, he catches a parademon in a net in the beginning. And I think that's the most he does in the whole movie. Yeah. And I'm not joking. I'm not lying. I'm not over exaggerating. I think that's the most like Batman-y he gets.
Well, he catches Barry when Barry's running at super speed and trips.
I don't understand.
Yeah.
Like Barry's running the speed, at least of sound, and Batman is able to see him trip and fire his Gatling gun to catch him. Within that, what, millisecond, I guess?
Yeah.
Like that. But anyway, in Batman, most of what Batman makes Batman is his psyche. That's why we love Batman. That and just the over, like, I can do anything. I can guide a plane down that's about to crash on my own without any help and everyone survive because I'm Batman. That's who we have come to know. But more than that, we've come to know his psyche, what defines him, how in the midst of pulverizing all the people he does, that he has a code. And that's probably what's just gridded me this entire thing is that this Batman has no code. He's the most unethical person you will ever meet. He kills about 50 people.
Brands the ones he sends to prison so they can be identified and receive some kind of prison justice.
In this movie, he is, let me see if I can remember. They're talking about, so spoiler warning, but I don't even think that counts anymore. Sorry. You should have watched it now. But they're arguing for, bringing Superman back from the dead and with the MacGuffin. And the Batman that we know is like super smart and super wise. He's never hasty unless he knows it's going to work. And even if he knows it's like, even though we think it's hasty, really, we'll find out later that he had it all planned all along. That's who we know as Batman. And this Batman is like, I know it's a million and one chance and we could probably destroy like all of Metropolis if this goes wrong. And we haven't ran any numbers, but I think we should do it because, I mean, two of us fought the bad guy and didn't seem like we had much luck under the water. So we really need Superman.
So let's just bring him back from the dead. Yeah.
Let's just risk, however many people are in Metropolis, because they've already said this thing is a box of untold power, infinite power. This thing could, if it can raise the dead to life, then, if it blows up, what would it do? And it's other people arguing that we should care about human life and what it does. We should care about the ones living and we should care and respect the ones in death. That is Batman. What's being spoken back at Bruce is Batman. And by the end of the movie, Batman is justified for being unethical. Like he's oh, thank you for bringing me back. There's no fallout to his decisions. They're best buddies. In fact, situations have been improved since in many people's lives. So it's when we see Batman cave in to his baser instincts, we always see him lose.
That's a great point.
And so he knows and he has a code, especially when it comes about the importance. And what I would say, Batman has a severe theology of the Imago Dei, is what I would say, like theologically, that he knows, if not explicitly, then he knows internally and has honed it by experience and by what he's seen, that every person made in the image of God is important and valuable. And that, and something that Superman does too. Like Superman doesn't go off and kill people either.
Unless you're Zod.
Yeah, unless you're Zod in this universe, which is why Man of Steel was so maddening. Mm-hmm. Like it's not halfway, it's probably I would say after Wonder Woman, it's probably the best film in the series. But it's so maddening because we all know Superman, what makes Superman Superman is that he can be, he can see an impossible situation where both choice A and B will come to utter destruction or devastation, and he still finds a way. to fix everything somehow. Even if there is some loss, that loss is to himself. He bears the brunt of the attack instead of letting others die or others be affected. That's what makes Superman Superman. Not in this movie. He rather kills someone instead of doing the hard work of using his brain. Same thing with Batman. He rather kill and then do the hard work of how to convince these people to stop their evil deeds.
That is so very well said. I particularly resonate with your points about Barry Allen, Superman. I mean, you've said everything needful about Batman. You've nailed that down to the wall. The point that I'm going to make later in this episode, I don't want to step on too much, though, is that if Superman is willing to kill, Lex Luthor all of a sudden has a very good point. And he stops being a character that you think, oh, this is a wacko, what's he doing? To someone who's maybe acting in their best interests. I lay a lot of that at Zack Snyder's feet. But
yes. And to a degree, I really wish they would, you know, they talked about, like, you'll see why he had to kill Zod in the next one. And I don't think we ever do. But I wish actually that, I mean, he made a point when he said that. I'm like, okay, it goes against everything Superman is, but okay, maybe I'll treat him a little more human, and especially if he's growing up in today's culture, I'll grant him that, and let's see what you do. And they outside of the, you know, place where he's going before the Supreme Court or the whatever, and all the people are protesting him outside. That's like the only, I think, cut we really see of, you know, people seeing him as you're supposed to be the savior. Saviors don't do that. We don't get any reward from that, which I thought was really sad about that movie.
Well, you've been very generous with your time. I don't mean to keep you tied up longer than I initially asked for, but maybe to bring this kind of back in a loop here with characters who are not who we've known them to be over our extensive trajectory with them in history. I'm one of those rare guys who, while I love both Marvel and DC, and I have a long history with both of them, my heart bends toward DC. And this is not original with me, but someone once said that the heroes in DC Comics would be heroes if they never got powers.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
that's entirely true of Barry Allen. You know, when Barry Allen actually disappears into the Speed Force and he's replaced by Wally West, Wally West is characterized by being inspired by Barry Allen. You know, his driving force is to live up to that legacy. And you're absolutely right. What we see in Justice League just is it's not just a pale shadow. It doesn't even rise to that. It's a complete departure, which even from a base pragmatic standpoint, why not use the material and the characterization that has shown itself to be something people resonate with? People from multiple generations, different backgrounds. You know, there's something about the classic comic book characterization that really sells itself to people over and over again. Why throw that away? But Justice League decided they wanted to.
Yeah, and like you said, I lay that at the feet of Zack Snyder that per his own words, and you can look this up, he wanted to deconstruct the superhero genre. Mm-hmm. And that's Marvel's job. Marvel's job is making selfish people into heroes. That's not DC's job. DC's is an optimist view of superheroes. Like that, like you said, even if these people weren't going to get superpowers, they'd still be heroes. That most of them start at a place of perfection, and we may like bring them down just a little bit in terms of getting their hands dirty maybe a little bit, but their true character is always winning out. That's not the story of most Marvel comics I've read, at least anytime recently. So
yeah. Well, hey, thanks again for being so generous with your time. I wanted, if you've got another minute, I know you've got a very large following already, but I wanted to give you a chance to let people know what your work is now. And if they're not familiar with you, figure out, hey, what are you aiming at doing through your work, and how can they connect with you doing it? So talk to us about the Calvinist Batman podcast. Talk to us about the Theology League, anything else that you've got brewing.
Sure. So I do three different shows. The first one is Calvinist Batman Reads System. Sorry, it's Calvinist Batman and Friends. That's the main show where I have authors usually or speakers on and we talk about a variety of topics. And we just are, I think by the time this posts, we'll have Matthew Barrett, who's an amazing writer and theologian and professor. He's on the show talking about theology of the Reformation. So they're lighthearted talks. They're not like super crazy. And I try to keep that door open for the person who's brand new into theology or Reformed theology. And kind of be that first step into the door for them. So it's a very lighthearted show and easy. It usually goes about an hour. The second show is Calvinist Batman Reads Systematic Theology, where I am making systematic theology audiobooks at about 20 minutes a segment. We're going through Voss's Reformed Dogmatics. So that's probably the easiest old systematic theology I could think of. So and that's been quite beneficial. And then every once in a while, when three of us, myself, the super theologian, or Kyle James Howard, and then Calvinist Girl, who's on Twitter, but still is anonymous, when we all three are at an event together, we do a show called The Theology League and talk about current issues. And we've talked that we need to do the show more, because I think the last time we did the show is last year or the year before or something like that. So it's been on hiatus for a little bit, but you can still look at past episodes, and especially in the current light of everything that's going on in our nation, the past episodes, even from 2 years ago, are finding itself quite prophetic. So, and you can look me up on Twitter at Calvinist Batman or on Facebook. So,
and the .com is Calvinist Batman as well, right?
Yes.
Well, guys who are listening to this, if you're thinking, oh yeah, I want to jump in and see what Calvinist Batman is doing, and you're looking for an entry point, for me, I've been thinking through political theory in light of my ultimate identity in Christ. And one of the episodes that I've got queued up to listen to, I haven't started yet, but you had Jonathan Lehman on, is that right?
Yes. Yeah, he's coming back on the show in just a few weeks.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, so we did a politics series, I'm pretty sure is the one you're talking about, where I had Russell Moore, I had, who did I have? Andy Nassali, Jonathan on, and then we ended it with someone important. I forget who it was. But we talked about politics kind of straight through in a multitude of different angles. And so that's still to date one of the favorite things I've ever done. So it was back in April of 2016. So they're marked the politics series. So you should be able to find them.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, I'm looking forward to listening to the one from April 16 and then this new one. Thanks for doing that. And yeah, I'm just looking forward to it. So thanks again for being on, man. I appreciate your time.
No problem. Thank you.
With that established, Jared, you want to talk for a little while about kind of the raw material of this movie? We'll walk through our worldview analysis, creation, fall, redemption, glorification. So we're looking to see how this story reflects the true story that God is telling about his son, Jesus Christ. Is it telling us the truth about these elements? Is it telling us something false about those things? So, Jared, what's the inherent goodness of creation that you see in the world of Justice League?
It's pretty much mimics our world. It's a beautiful world, but a dangerous world, a world of both good and evil. And men can choose one or the other, but men always, it seems, need superheroes, supermen and women to save them.
Yeah, you know, this movie is part of the DC Extended Universe, their cinematic universe, DC's version of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And it's built on stuff that has come before. So we have seen Man of Steel. We've seen Batman versus Superman, Wonder Woman. There's been a few movies that have predated this. This world catches up with a lot of that story. This is a fantastical world. I don't know that we always think of Batman and Superman or Captain America and Spider-Man as being in the same genre as, I'm trying to think, you know, Frodo and Samwise, or Aslan and the Pevensey children. But in a lot of ways, this movie is playing with the same stuff. It may not originate its magical properties in the same place as those stories do, but this is a fun imaginary world to live in, and it invites the reader's imagination into considering what it would be like to be more than human. You know, there's a famous game, and I'm sure I've asked you this before, maybe even on a previous episode, but it's fun to imagine, even as a guy in my mid-30s, if I could have a superpower, what would it be? Let me catch you cold with that one, Jared. If you could have any superpower in the world, which one would you take?
I think maybe turn back time.
Okay. Would you go back and mess with the time stream, like correct errors in the past? Okay. You're not afraid of like creating multiple branching timelines and dystopian futures?
Well, I think I could go back and change those if I did.
You're the one who can do it appropriately, right?
Well, of course, if you've got the superpower to do it. No, man, you know as well as I do that any, I mean, it's a mere, it's wonderful that we can only do as much damage as we can, you know, like,
yeah,
it's wonderful we're not demigods. And I mean, good grief, if we had much more power, look at what we've done. Look at the 20th century.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's true. And I took that in a much more depressing direction. For my part, I would go much less grandiose. I would love to be able to fly. You know, we're getting just a little glimpse of spring weather in our part of the country. And I noticed on my ride in today, the first time I saw animals, excuse me, I saw birds in the air, you know, where birds will find a pocket of warm air and they will just sort of basically hover by staying in the updraft. And I remember thinking, I saw one of those, saw a hawk doing that today. And I just thought, there's few things in this world I wouldn't give to be able to do that for 30 minutes, let alone, you know, take off and fly to wherever I wanted to. So give
that's
me flight.
Cool, man.
Yeah.
I did not peg you for someone wanting to fly. That's cool.
Yeah, I'd love to. So anyway, this is a magical world. It's fun to daydream and imagine. I'm not saying that we should desire to transcend the creaturely limits that God has placed upon us, but I do think in a faith that tells us that someday we will live beyond the touch of death, there's something sort of like that when you imagine, and what would it be like to be able to run at super speeds or have the ability to lift, you know, tremendous amounts of weight. So there's a goodness to that. There's a fun imagination element that's part of the world we're in here. So there's that. What about fallenness?
Fallenness is, I mean, there's evil people. There's evil people all over the place. And it seems that there's always a new superhero movie because there's more evil people who rear their heads, you know, and they'll take over and destroy everything that is good unless someone intervenes.
Yeah. One of the things I appreciate about the DC EU, it comes from Wonder Woman, which if you haven't heard our review of that film, you can find that in our archives. Would love to encourage you to listen to that one and then give us your feedback on the episode. But one of the central plot elements of that story is that Diana, not living in the world of men, has this naivete that all of warfare basically can be traced back to the god of warfare, Ares. And she thinks, if I go into men's world and I find Ares and kill him, I will eliminate their propensity for war. But what she finds out is, yeah, Ares may be having an impact on the way men pursue warfare, but even when he's kind of taken out of the picture, they still do these things, right? And there's a disillusionment that comes from that. She sort of gets to meet the world the way it is. And in that sense, I think the DC Cinematic Universe is telling us the truth. There are supernatural intelligences and powers that are interested in provoking brutality among men. But also, men are very interested in doing that on their own accord. Yes, we live in a world of powers and principalities and a present darkness. But we are also descendants, not just of, you know, Adam and Eve, but we're related to their children, Cain and Abel, the first fratricide in human history, right? We have killing our brother baked into a genetic level. And so the cinematic universe tells us the truth about some of those things.
Mm-hmm.
This is beyond the movie of Justice League, but I think this movie raises it and I want to highlight it at this juncture. I think one of the reasons that some people dislike this movie is because Batman versus Superman, the predecessor, Dawn of Justice, it soured them on basically the DC cinematic universe because of, in my opinion, Zack Snyder, who was the primary creative shaping intelligence on the DC cinematic universe until Justice League. And Zack had delivered years ago an adaptation of Watchmen, which was an Alan Moore creation, one of the first postmodern comics. It took apart the comic medium. It showed the dark underbelly of superheroes in a way that seems more adult, I think, to a certain understanding. So the heroes there weren't fighting for truth, justice in the American way. They were subject to all the most deplorable vices of humanity. So it's a famous comic from a famous creator. Zack Snyder takes it, and he delivered what I think is a pretty faithful adaptation of Watchmen. But then he's given stewardship over the DC universe. And what he doesn't seem to understand is that the Watchmen was, again, deconstructionist, dystopian. It was a commentary on comics in a lot of way. And that what made Watchmen compelling as a one-off is not what sustains comic books as a medium over the scope of their popularity, basically. And so in Zack Snyder's DC universe, the heroes are particularly fallen. So in Batman versus Superman, Batman has become jaded and cynical to a degree that even as he's fighting crime, he brands people so that they will be identified when they go into prison and they'll receive prison justice. And the even worse example of that for me is that in the Superman origin movie, Man of Steel, when you have Superman talking to his parents, Superman is basically treated by his dad as a closeted homosexual in the sense that people can't know this about you. And then by the time you get to his encounter with General Zod later on, Superman's willing to kill General Zod. Then when you get to Dawn of Justice, Zack Snyder has rightly understood that Superman is very much a Christ figure in literature, but he's doing the postmodern deconstructionist thing again. So you have a Superman who is deeply conflicted about whether or not he can identify with humanity. Does he care for this strange race of beings that he does not come from, but he lives among? And he has these dialogues with his mom who tells him, look, be their savior, basically. Or she says, forget them. They don't deserve you. You just pick whichever one. And that plays out in a couple different scenes that I think Zack Snyder thought were really cool, but I don't think he appreciates the way it destroys the characterization. So in Dawn of Justice, one of the most telling is there's this flood scene and there's this woman and her family on top of a roof and they're reaching out for someone to come save them. Superman shows up, but he hovers over their house and the woman is reaching up to him, obviously calling out to him, but it's clearly religious imagery that he's playing with there. And Zack Snyder's thinking, there's a cool image that kind of drives home the Christ metaphor, but Superman is taking a moment to hover above someone he should be saving. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah.
And what you end up being left with is a real sympathy for the Lex Luthor of Zack Snyder's consideration. The Lex Luthor of Batman versus Superman Dawn of Justice is building a weapon to use against Superman because he sees Superman as a threat. Well, yes, if Superman isn't really sure that he likes humanity and wants to help them, Lex Luthor has a really good point. We should have a means of defending ourselves against him. And that's what the brokenness of Zack Snyder's moral vision leaves you with. And I think that's why up until Wonder Woman, which started sort of reversing the trend of everything has to be cast in shades of moral gray, I think up until Wonder Woman, that's why the regular audience who just shows up to the movies to watch a good story ended up not feeling very connected to this cinematic universe. Even if we're not conscious of it, or even if we're people who say, I don't believe in a God, I think religion's dangerous, we don't want to see a morally ambivalent Superman. Or if we want to see that, we're not going to show up to see that in multiple installations. It's exhausting to us. We want a Superman who's not terrifying. We want a Superman who, is adopted by humanity and at the same time adopts humanity and becomes one of the best examples of humanity from that position as an adopted outsider who's been brought in. You get what I'm saying there?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, we don't go to superheroes because they're like us. I mean, that's not, and the good guy always wins for a reason. I mean, people want a story where, they want to identify with these super characters and the good that they do.
Absolutely. And I want to say that I'm sure there are people listening to this podcast who say, oh, yeah, yeah, I want more, quote unquote, I hate this description, but mature superhero stories. But the thing that has sustained these stories and have made them continually relevant to new generations and new creators who are telling fresh stories with the characters is that this is a moral, comic books are a moral world. We've forgotten that in postmodern or advanced modernity, whichever label you apply to our cultural moment. We have done the Zack Snyder thing and said everything's shades of gray. Every outwardly appearing noble person has a dark underbelly. We're always looking for the hypocrisy and the letdown. And really, in a lot of ways, we've learned that because we're used to seeing public figures fall. We're used to seeing authority be used for abuse rather than the good of those who are under its power And that's really, you know, in a lot of ways, the superhero thing. They have these great powers. What are they going to do? Are they going to be tyrants? Are they going to be servants? Well, because we actually live in a world spoken into existence by a super powerful being who made us in his image and who is fundamentally a servant to his creatures in a way that we absolutely do not deserve. Even people who are hostile to religion can't help but sort of come back around to that in the stories that we're telling in modern mythology, like Superman. So I say all that to say these movies up until basically Wonder Woman and I think Justice League were cutting their own feet off from underneath them by trying to give us a Christ figure who is deeply morally ambivalent in a way that Christ isn't. And I'm not surprised that those stories failed to catch the imagination of a broad audience.
Right.
So I guess really to bring it down to a particular point, fallenness in this movie isn't just an element within the story where bad guys do evil things. I think this movie is a product of fallenness in its own creator, not Big C creator, but thinking about Zack Snyder, Geoff Johns, people who had creative control over these franchises. I think they were evidencing a particular kind of fallenness that affected these movies for very much for the worst, if that makes sense.
Hmm.
What about redemption? Where does redemption come from?
I think it's through the community of these superheroes joining together to conquer evil. They can't do it on their own.
Yes. So this movie tells us that teamwork is a positive virtue, right?
Right.
And I mean, that's not something we're going to criticize, I guess. I think sometimes that we think of teamwork as too much of a virtue, as if there were some inherent goodness to it, rather than it being a useful tool if connected to a servant-heartedness, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think if you want to see this done well in a superhero movie, in a way even better than Justice League, I'm a big fan of The Incredibles, the animated movie.
Mm, yeah.
That roots the image of teamwork within a family. Now, there's flaws there. They have to figure some stuff out. But you come away with seeing these exceptional people. It's a good thing for exceptional people to serve other people. And it's really good if exceptional people see themselves as servants who then link arms with other exceptional servants. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And we're getting a new Incredibles movie very soon, and I cannot wait to watch it.
Oh, yeah. Let's review it on this.
Absolutely. Any other redemptive elements we want to highlight here?
I don't believe so. Glorification.
Well, before we move on there's one thing I do want to note, and it's one of the reasons I think that families should reconsider this. In fact, if you have kids who are old enough to do some of this, this may be a fun project to do. Again, if your conscience and what you let your children or, you know, your peer set, if y'all can agree to watch these movies and nobody be offended, and I say if you can agree, I'm not saying that should be your aim or your project, but if that's your conscience, that these movies are on the table, it's a good idea to take Batman Dawn of Justice and show the scene I referenced earlier where Martha Kent is telling Superman, basically love him or leave him, it doesn't matter, you just pick. There's no transcendent truth that's calling you to serve them. You just, whatever's in your heart, you do it. And then show Superman floating above a flooding victim. Then flip it over to the end of this movie where Superman has come back from the dead and the woman he loves the most has told him, yeah, I know you've got to go fight more evil, but don't die this time. And he flies off to go confront this big bad guy. He gets there and starts the fight, but then he realizes civilians are in danger and he immediately leaves to go take care of them. Him and the Flash head off, and Superman immediately, instead of just drifting above people, watching them reach out to him with some kind of existential yearning, he just picks up their house and moves them out of danger. Then he goes back to the battle and there's this pressing need to pull apart these mother boxes, and it's clearly on the table. This may kill you, but he doesn't hesitate. You know, this guy's mm-hmm. back from the dead. He doesn't hesitate. He grabs the box and starts pulling it open. That's a much more compelling Superman here in this movie, and the contrast between him as a character in this film versus Dawn of Justice, I think, is a wonderful teaching opportunity to kind of walk through the morality of people with giftedness. Well, you know, all people are called to serve in a way that looks like Christ as a servant, but it's particularly those of us who have a giftedness, an exceptionality that is given to us as a stewardship from our Creator. It's particularly important that we're servant-hearted mm-hmm. and that we give ourselves for the benefit of other people. So I think you can see redemption even in the way this character has changed as Zack Snyder's control lessened. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you mentioned it earlier, glorification. What do we do with glorification here?
When the good guys work together and win.
There's a better world.
There's a better world, and at least temporarily.
Yeah. So there's a better world that's not under threat from these super powerful alien intelligences. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when they do put down the big bad threat at the end, there's an interesting almost return to Eden. You know, we go to this Russian town that has such a funny name. It's like Bizarristan or something like that. I can't remember, but it's clearly, you know, playing off an English root. And it looks like what I imagine maybe Chernobyl or, mm-hmm. you know, some abandoned Russian land looks like. At one point, one of the heroes asks, what kind of people live here? And I think Aquaman says people who have nowhere else to go. Well, this invader comes in, starts using this otherworldly technology, and these, you know, big tendrils of power and no telling what else start reshaping this town. And it puts all the people who live there in danger. But when they beat him, when they beat the invader, when the Justice League drives off the invading force, it turns into that structure that had been reshaping the town turns into this beautiful plant life. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the movie, and this is one of the things I think also people should give this movie a fresh look. By the end of this movie, you don't have a Superman who's wrestling with, what do I do with these gifts that I've been given? And do I even want to live a public life as a superhero? Am I going to be, you know, a servant, or am I going to let these people live in the filth of their own making? He clearly is enjoying himself by the end of this movie. So him and Flash take off on a race to see who's faster. And there's a childlikeness there that is not childish that I think really invites the watcher into the joy of imagination again. You know, if you and I are friends, if you were super fast and I could fly and I could fly really fast, we would race pretty quickly early on. You know what mm-hmm. I'm saying? That's just what we would do. And that's an appropriate way to revel in the imaginary goodness of this world. So yeah, it's glorification in we work together, things are going to get better. It's drawn on Edenic imagery, but these guys also enjoy the goodness of the gifts they've been given in a way that sets it apart from previous movies, in a way that I think says something to believers who are gifted by our Creator with, again, gifts as a stewardship to be used, but also to be enjoyed. Mm-hmm. So we've chopped it up here with a worldview analysis. Let's get into the questions where we want to start putting it back together to find useful material for our enjoyment of the Lord and also to serve our brothers and sisters in the church, also our neighbor. You know, what's the story? We just got done walking through some of that. Where am I though, Jared? Where do you see yourself in this imaginary world?
I'm probably one of the humans depending on one of the superheroes to save me, or I'm Batman.
Yeah, I think it's pretty clear you're Batman.
That's right. But he's kind of a wimp in this one.
Yeah, that's actually my major problem with this movie, storyline wise. Mm-hmm. He spends the whole movie saying, "Oh, I've got to find a leader to lead this team. I've got to find a leader to lead this team." That's hogwash. Batman is automatically the guy that is in control of any room he steps into.
He goes from killing Superman almost in the last one, right, to being kind of a weenie in this one.
Yeah, there's a funny scene where, again, this is not a strength. These are some of my criticisms, basically Batman's portrayal. There is this scene where Superman and he are talking pretty much the first time after Superman has been resurrected. When Superman comes back, he's very angry at Batman. And so he just pitches a fit and is just breaking everybody till eventually Lois Lane comes and calms him down. But by the time they meet up again, Superman's got his head back on his shoulders and they're talking. And Superman says, "Well, I know you didn't bring me back because you like me." And Batman kind of stammers through, "I didn't not like you." But then we see Superman operating. He's just, you know, full display of powers, kicking tail. And Batman puts this stupid grin on his face and is just like, "Oh, wow." And he totally fanboys out watching Superman. It's super goofy. And it's just not consistent with who Batman has been basically since he first started being published, you know? Mm-hmm. That's me. Helpfully, this movie reminds me that my well-being is really predicated on the intervention of greater beings than myself. And really a lot of danger in my life comes from that too. You know, we've talked about it in other places that we really do live in a world where there are unseen, incredibly powerful, hostile intelligences watching us in a way we can't see them. I mean, it would drive you to paranoia if it weren't actually how things are. Mm-hmm. But thankfully, that's not the only element that's present here. There is a creator who has taken my well-being in the fullest sense of that word as his own priority. And ultimately, that's going to be the most determinative criteria of how these supernatural beings affect my life. Mm-hmm. What do you see in this movie that's true and good and beautiful? What's awesome? Where do you see common grace?
I think the principle of community is right. Can't save the world alone. Man was not meant to be alone. You know, he needs woman. Men and women need friends. Our need for others is evident. Even Batman needs others in this movie. Gets right how we should respond to evil. Where there is evil, it must be fought. And if you can't defeat it yourself, you've got to seek out others or someone greater than yourself. Or, the Bible says that's part of the reason why the government was created, why it's given authority by God. And then I think the movie gets the definition of hero right. You know, heroes put others above themselves, even to the point of self-sacrifice in order to save others. Heroes even deny themselves. They deny their wants and desires for the sake of the greater good. Batman's a loner, but he cannot save the world by himself. And there's something more important than Batman's emotions, his desires. Saving the world is more important. So Batman's authentic self is irrelevant in this movie. There's an objective calling beyond his desires. He must defeat evil. And the movie gets right that we need someone not subject to death if we're to be saved.
That's well said.
Superman died in order to save others in Batman versus Superman, and this movie rises from the dead. You've already pointed that out. And something, I thought something interesting about that reality was, Superman uses his ice breath to freeze Steppenwolf's axe.
Yeah, so
Wonder Woman.
Jared, just a second. We got a little bit of digital static there, just to clarify the record. You said Superman uses his breath,
his ice breath, to freeze Steppenwolf's axe.
Yeah,
and so Wonder Woman then shatters it with her sword. And I just thought that was an interesting choice that the superhero who rose from the dead, Superman, and the demigod, half god, half woman, Wonder Woman, are the two who take away Steppenwolf's means of hurting people, so his axe. And the reason why that's interesting is because, you know, from a Christian perspective, and I don't know if that this is by design, but consider Superman and Wonder Woman as types of Christ. Yeah. Or representations of Christ.
Yeah, pale imitations, but nonetheless.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I think there's some argument there, design there. Like Wonder Woman is supposed to be Superman at the very least is a Christ figure, at least based on those who originally created him. And then Wonder Woman is supposed to be a type of Superman. And so I just think it's interesting because Steppenwolf, you know, representing Satan, and you consider how Satan controls humanity or how he harms humanity. It's through sin. And so once Christ took care of our sins, he took away Satan's means for controlling the elect. He took away. I mean, it's I don't know. I'm probably reading too much into it, but I just thought that was a cool illustration.
Yeah, yeah. And we've talked about the demigod thing, particularly in our episode on Moana, which we'd encourage you to go back and read the write-up for if you want to look at like text-based analysis of the concept of the demigod. The demigod is a half human and a half man. That's not what Jesus is. Jesus is fully God, fully man. But demigod sort of apes that truth in a very poor way, right? Mm-hmm. And that's true for Wonder Woman. She's in that way, she's a pale imitation of Christ, but you sort of see a little bit of him through her. If I can jump back a little bit, your idea that even Batman needs a team or Batman needs people in this movie is one I had not considered, but I think one that's really strong. Part of Batman's appeal is that he kind of confirms or gives us an imaginary entrance into the ultimate individualism that is so much of America's intellectual and social fiber. You know, we want to live as if everything about our life is only dependent upon us. And Batman gives us this false impression that, you know, if we'd been born super rich, we could basically be Superman. I mean, we could basically be Batman. We just have to train hard enough and have enough money. And he is the ultimate individualist. But as you've noticed, it's helpful for this movie to point out that even our fictionalized representations of that idea aren't ultimately sustainable. And that speaks to how truly unsustainable it is to attempt to live that out in the real world.
Right, right. And I mean, if Batman, you know, if he wasn't helping people, you'd call him a narcissist.
Yes. I mean, and that's something that shows up in comics too, that, you know, is this guy, is he helpful or is he a dude dressed up as a vampire beating up mentally ill people? You know what I mean? Like,
oh, wow. Yeah.
Different creators have played with that.
Yeah. It's like he doesn't need anyone, but everyone needs Batman. You know, it's,
can you really love a character like that? You know, or is he the mentally ill one? That character has a lot of, you can do a lot with it. You mentioned another thing that I wanted to highlight. If our listeners aren't familiar, Superman was born out of the imagination of two Jewish young men. And you remember the time frame in which his creation appears, right? So, but starting about 1880 into about 1920, there's a huge influx of Jewish immigrants to America. And then by the time the creators of Superman, Siegel and Shuster, are playing with their creative talents, you're watching this guy named Adolf Hitler become the Chancellor of Germany, and there's an anti-Jewish sentiment, you know, that's ramping up in America. And there's a lot of good scholarship on Superman as a Jewish figure of redemption. So I'll put this in our subreddit, but Den of Geek has a piece called Mensch of Steel, Superman's Jewish Roots. And they point out that Superman in some ways is very similar to Rabbi Lowe's Golem of Prague. And I said Golem, it's Golem. But, you know, this Golem is a character who was created to protect the Jewish community from oppressors. It was designed to give strength and hope. It fought for justice for this oppressed people. And a lot of that same stuff is playing out with Superman. There's more, though. Den of Geek points out that there are parallels with Superman's story and Moses's. I'm going to quote them, but I'm going to quote that piece. Both Superman and Moses were born in times of crisis. For Superman, he was born to a dying planet. In Moses' case, he was in real danger of being killed by the Pharaoh. So both of the parents make this choice to send their sons out into the unknown, either across space and time or down the river, you know, famously populated with giant crocodiles. Faith here ultimately pays off. They land in the arms of a loving stranger. That those infants find a safe home where they're not just raised and cared for, but they're nurtured in that into a sense of being part of the tribe of humanity and, you know, called to like give themselves to their people in some way. And I think that's not reading too much into the story. I think Superman clearly is a product of the Judeo worldview, and I think pretty quickly develops into a product of a Judeo-Christian worldview. I think that's part of why he's so compelling. And on the subject of him being a Christ figure, there is a book called, it's actually a novel. It's called The Book of Lies. But the guy who wrote The Book of Lies pays a lot of attention to Superman's origin in the imagination of his creators. Let me just read this to you, Jared. I think you'll find this interesting. This is from The Telegraph in the UK, and the title is called The Tragic Real Story Behind Superman's Birth, which I'll also post this in our subreddit. Here's an excerpt. It appears that personal tragedy, rather than a quest to win over their peers, could be the real story behind Superman's birth. On June 2, 1932, Jerry Siegel's father, Mitchell, a Jewish immigrant from Lithuania, died during a night robbery at his Cleveland secondhand clothes store. The 60-year-old fell to the ground during the robbery. According to the police report, gunshots were heard. Siegel's family and the coroner, however, said he died of a heart attack. Was it the sudden loss of his father that pushed a distraught 17-year-old to invent a bulletproof super being to avenge evil and fight for good? Well, that's the theory of best-selling author Brad Meltzer, who researched Mitchell Siegel's death for his new novel, The Book of Lies, which draws parallels between Siegel's murder and another true mystery, the killing of Abel by his brother Cain. So we start getting quotes. In 50 years of interviews, Jerry Siegel never once mentioned that his father died in a robbery, Meltzer told USA Today. But think about it. Your father dies in a robbery, and you invent a bulletproof man who becomes the world's greatest hero. I'm sorry, but there's a story there. Mm. That's Meltzer. I think he's onto something. The piece goes on to say that although Superman did not appear in print until 1938 on the cover of Action Comics, writer Jerry Siegel and artist Schuster originally came up with a character first dubbed the Superman 6 years earlier, quote, just weeks after Jerry Siegel's father was killed, Mr. Meltzer writes on his website. In one of the oldest surviving sketches, Superman rushes to the rescue of a man being held up by a masked robber. Here's Meltzer again. America did not get Superman from our greatest legends, but because a boy lost his father. Superman came not out of our strength, but out of our vulnerability. Hmm. There's a lot there, and it's a compelling thesis. I've heard a similar version of this that I couldn't track down the sources on, so I'm not going to cite it as such, but I've also heard Superman is basically the secularist Jewish Messiah, that these guys weren't particularly involved in their faith. I can't confirm or deny that, but they were still looking for the concept of the Messiah that had been so much of part of their community's conception of the world, this awaited figure who would set things right, that they went and created the Superman. I think that last line that Meltzer gives is really important to understanding Superman as a Christ figure and as kind of the impetus for me saying we need to reconsider this movie. That last line is Superman came not out of our strength, but out of our vulnerability. Jesus Christ had the power to do whatever he wanted to his creation at any moment that he chose, of course, in consistency with his father's will. But what defines Jesus as a savior is the way his power is manifested through his vulnerability, right? He is the sort of savior who can be nailed to a cross and demonstrates his power through the triumph of the cross. Now, of course, there's the return to glorification through the resurrection and the ascension and the exaltation. Absolutely true. But in the way that Superman is vulnerable to the emotional hurts because he loves a woman and he loves humanity, vulnerable to these powers that can take his life, and he willingly gives his life to defeat the evil. And then the way he comes back, I think all those things really put him in front of us and say basically the reason generations of people, new generations, different cultures, different creators, you know, he's a transcendent pop culture artifact from Western culture at this point. And I think it's basically because he does a pretty good job of being a bad copy, but one of the better bad copies of who Jesus Christ is. Mm-hmm. And so we should pay attention very carefully to the stories that are told about him. Don't let Zack Snyder goof him up. Give him to somebody who understands the importance of this figure. What's distorted evil and false here, Jared? How can I subvert idolatry?
I think that the idol in this movie is that good and evil are always with us. A yin-yang presentation of good and evil kind of in this movie. The ultimate reality in this movie is kind of the world as you see it. Now, there's metahumans and aliens, but it's a world without an ultimate good creator. Mm. And so there's no ultimate reason given for man to do good or evil. It's just reality. You know, you choose one or the other.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. That arbitrariness rather is the Achilles heel of this universal brotherhood of mankind, echo that still remains in our culture. We believe ourselves to be cosmic accidents. The only higher purpose we have is to reproduce. And yet we still find ways to tell these stories about, well, it's good to be in community. It's good to partner with your neighbors. It's good to, not live on an island. And our worldview has no ability to explain those things. It doesn't realize you can't say both, basically, and be intellectually consistent.
Right. And it's interesting, man. It's interesting how, even this movie ends with Lex Luthor plotting to organize the Legion of Doom. It's just one, they defeat one evil and another one comes up, and then they defeat it and then another one, and so on and so on. It's unending.
Yeah, I guess that is, I want to give them charitably, if you're going to be telling stories of superheroes, you're going to have to always find a new way to generate a new threat, right?
Sure.
Or bring a defeated enemy back into focus. But sure, that's a depressing view of history. And I think a lot of people see history that way, right? We have this idea that history is cyclical and that, what goes around comes around quite literally in human history. I think you and I would both agree that we do see patterns in history and themes, mm-hmm. but I know we agree that history is moving in a linear direction to the glorification of Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you really do believe that history is just basically a comic book, bad guys pop up, good guys try to fight it. Sometimes they're successful, sometimes they're not. Then the cycle repeats itself. That story has nothing to offer you as, you know, a human being to give you a vision of life that compels you to see it as worth living. And I'm not saying that everyone who's a secularist is suicidal or nihilistic, but that view of history is inherently nihilistic. And I'm not surprised that some people reading it honestly conclude, I'm just going to end my existence.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that's an evil choice. It's a choice that brings immense suffering to other people. But again, I just want to note that our cultural narrative pushes people to those conclusions.
Yeah, it does. And it seems to be pushing more and more. I find it strangely, it's fascinating, man. I mean, life is literally better, I mean, historically, right, than it's ever been in the history of the world.
Yeah.
And people are taking their lives more and more, it seems. There was a doctor, a doctor that I knew this past week, who just took his life. And 62 years old.
Hmm.
I mean, I would go, you know, he did surgery on one of my members, and he insisted that we pray. I mean, he was an outspoken Christian. And,
wow.
Yeah, it's just heartbreaking. It's heart-wrenching. It seems that he made a quick wrong decision, decision he couldn't take back. And it's sad. But what, I don't know, this mentality that we've got to be, I don't know if it's superheroes or social media or what it is, but we've got to be, our American idealism, we've got to be the best. You know, it's not good enough to be who God made us to be. We have to be the best at what we do. And I think that's a trap. You know, I don't know what happened with this fella, but there's, you know, it goes to social media, it goes to, you know, we have to be liked by everybody, or everybody, if we're passionate about something, everybody else has to think that it's the best thing ever, or we're going to be miserable.
Well, that sounds like a people, and I think neither one of us is trying to say that social media or a nihilistic worldview is going to be the sum total of explaining why things happen like a good doctor taking his life happens. But we also want to say these are some of the ways that it seems quite obvious contribute to the thinking that leads people to that end. It's ultimately an expression of sinfulness, but just being charitable to our neighbors, what you're saying there about people need to see us as exceptional, people need to see us and what we're passionate about as important to themselves as well. It sounds like a people who are desperate to live in a big story that has consequence, that has transcendent meaning. And if we can't actually have the one, or we cast off or suppress an unrighteousness, the transcendent story that we're actually living in, we're going to try to manufacture one either through our accomplishments or our passions, or we're going to be left feeling like, well, the entire enterprise is broken, so I'm just going to check out early.
Right. Yeah, it's sad, man, because it's I don't know. It's very strange, the pressure, all this stuff, because it's very hard to pinpoint what exactly, you know, everybody's got an opinion too. When somebody takes their life, they're always wanting to blame somebody else, when ultimately the person responsible is the person who took his or her own life.
Yeah. So just a caveat that I think Jared and I would say that there is such a thing as mental illness that causes, sure, people to act irrationally and to act toward self-harm. But it seems mental illness has become the only narrative we have for people who take their own lives. And that's way too simplistic, that a great deal of what's going on, we can't shunt off easily as mental illness. We have to say this person, maybe from a place of great pain, but nonetheless, this person chose an evil course.
Right. And that's what's so sad is oftentimes you hear mental illness. I mean, I see it all the time, and the blaming of other people for, you know, if people are bullying these people, or people are hurt, they're going to answer for they should be called out for their sin. But no one causes someone to commit suicide unless they pull the trigger for them,
or they have some sort of, you know, the person, like, there's suicides where the person has had a break with reality, basically,
right,
or they've wrongly concluded that death would be preferable to living in this pain. I don't want to be unsympathetic, mm-hmm, particularly not for our listeners who have had people do this. We're not saying that your loved one was a moral monster for this choice. Right. But we are saying, unless you can point to some chemical troubles in the brain or, you know, something along those lines, or prolonged abuse, something like that, it is a monstrous choice to take your own life. And we need to have that as part of our mental tool bag for diagnosing this problem. Otherwise, we're not going to be able to get to the bottom of it, because we're looking for a route that crowds out some other really legitimate roots of the problem.
Right. I mean, you and I aren't medical doctors, but we can help folks spiritually. And I think both of us, from what you're saying, sounds like we agree that the majority of the time it's spiritual issues. It's a believing man rather than God. So instead of me believing what God says about me, made in his image, conforming me to the image of his son, I'm supremely valuable if everybody and their brother hates my guts. You know, they can't change God's value of me. And somebody's opinion cannot change it. Likes on Facebook and somebody bullying. None of those things, nothing anyone ever says or does, can change what God has said about me eternally. And there's great freedom in that. There's great. And so in order to take your life, because like to start basing your value on what other people think of you, you have to care more about their opinion, at least in those moments, than you care about God's truth, you know, his value of you. And that's the real danger. You know, I see it with bullying and in our society. You know, I'm thinking of teenagers because of the uptick of suicides. You know, teenagers are basically being taught that suicide is brave, that suicide's a legitimate option.
It's tragically noble.
Yeah. If they're being bullied, it's a legitimate option. And there's all this empathy and there's all this. And see, back in the day, man, it was so frowned upon that I guess what I'm saying is, man, is when something is accepted by society, you're going to see an uptick in it. I mean, it's, you know, if they make it a noble thing, you know, there's just going to be more and more of it.
Yeah. Yeah. There's certainly a sense in which media has contributed the idea that, or rather it's contributed to the idea. How am I trying to say this? I'm stumbling over it. More people see this as a credible option because we've come to see human life as stripped of dignity. It, you know, humans aren't exceptional anymore. They're just another part of this accidental creation. And we tell stories, and one of the most notable, Romeo and Juliet, right? The tragic lovers whose love leads them to take their own lives. But it's ramped up in the way that media spreads this image, and it's paying off in actually having more suicides. I actually think this is true for school shooting as well. I think media coverage has led to the increase we've seen in school shooting. So I guess we're a little bit afield here, but the point stands. We have to have a category for evil as a cause for human choices. Otherwise, we're not going to understand the world we live in. To put one last sort of check on some of the stuff we've been saying, I want you to hear me say explicitly, we're not telling you that if your loved one committed suicide, they should have just believed harder, right? They could have prayed it away. If they really fully bought into God's narrative about themselves, they'd be insulated from the pain that led them to take their life. But we are saying that we have real resources in God's giving us his image, giving us dignity, not only in giving us his image, but in sending his son to take up our nature and die on behalf of those who believe. There are real resources in that to combat a lot of the thinking that leads people to conclude that suicide is an acceptable option.
Yeah, and I would suggest, I mean, from this movie, you know, if any of our listeners are having suicidal thoughts, to talk with your pastor, talk with your elders, talk with your doctor, depending on who that, you know, I would prefer a believing doctor, someone who, a fellow Christian. But also I would, one of the best things, you know, that can help, in my opinion, is to put your hands to something good. So learn from this superhero movie. You know, to where you're giving yourself for others.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think there's much benefit in that.
Mm-hmm.
Much benefit. I mean, when you're worried about other people and focused on other people, I think it helps alleviate some of that inward focus.
Yeah, this is just anecdotal, but pastorally, this is not a silver bullet to take care of anxiety or depression. But pastorally, I've often seen it in people people who are struggling with a form of anxiety, depression, that if they will intentionally make a choice to give themselves to some specific service, they go volunteer at the rescue mission in their town, or they, you know, find some widows to go take care of in some way, getting them groceries, building accessible, you know, ramps and stuff into their housing, it has a positive effect on their on the person's experience of depression and anxiety. Again, not a silver bullet, but it does seem to be built into us that serving others is a real help, practically speaking, to our emotional and mental state.
Mm-hmm.
Jared, last question. How does the gospel apply in this movie?
I think this movie, the best it can be is temporary peace until an evil person attacks. And the gospel offers something that's ultimate, an ultimate fix to what's wrong with the world. You know, a superhero cannot fix anyone's heart. But when the Holy Spirit applies the finished work of Christ to our hearts, he transforms us from death into life. And through Christ, we are being perfected so that one day we'll be completely perfect like Christ and no longer live in a dangerous world. For Christ brings a new heaven and new earth where he reigns perfectly over a perfect people forever and ever. And so, even in the new heavens and new earth, you know, part of what I believe and what I believe Jeff believes this too is, you know, we're bound to our anthropology. We're bound to our nature. And something that the Lord is doing by taking on our nature, or has done, is we're being conformed to his image. And so the nature that my Lord and Savior possesses today, the human nature he possesses, one day I will possess that nature. And so your person is bound to your nature. And so if your nature is perfect, there's not going to be I assume in the new heavens and new earth, there's not going to be a capacity to sin in this new nature. And so because my person in the new heavens and new earth is always acting through my human nature, this perfected nature, and I'm bound to my nature, I'll never be able to sin again. So it's eradicated, and there's no possibility of some new evil. Evil's been judged and taken care of forever. I mean, that's such a wonderful picture, man, to think through what our loved ones are experiencing right now and what the new heavens and new earth is going to be like. And when folks talk about being bored about heaven, it just blows my mind. How could you know it's boring? Living in an evil world where boredom is possible. The new heavens and new earth, there's not going to be any boredom. You're not going to be bored with enjoying God's goodness for all eternity.
Absolutely right. He is the great subject that we will spend eternity exploring, and it will be truly fascinating.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, I know folks, you know, they think of, it's interesting. Folks think of a harp and an angel, you know, you're sitting on a cloud and playing a harp for all eternity or whatever. You know, until other people start saying something, I never even considered that would be boring. I mean, even if I did, I know that's wrong, but even if growing up, whenever I understood heaven and as a young man, I never thought, I mean, even if I was playing a harp for all eternity, I never considered that would be boring. yeah.
Because it is the thing you were designed by your creator to do if you played if that were the scenario, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't think the angels who are around the throne in Isaiah, who all they do day and night, holy, 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 I mean, I don't think they're bored.
No, they're riveted, right?
Yeah. I mean, can you imagine? I mean, you imagine you're riveted with your wife, you know, and I'm riveted with my wife and my children and the poems and the love that comes out of that. I mean, imagine seeing your creator, Savior, face to face, and all that he has done for you, and getting a glimpse of that, no longer seeing through the glass darkly or dimly. And just, I mean, it's just so compelling.
Yeah.
So compelling.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Jared, man, we're at the end of this thing. Anything else you got to add to the analysis of Justice League?
No, I think that's it, man. But I will say this. Now, it's the Marvel Universe, but I'm looking forward to Infinity. What is it? Infinity War?
Yeah. Yeah. Me too, man. Me too. Marvel has kicked DCEU's hindy in terms of box office sales. I feel like...
Can I say one negative thing about this movie?
No. Yes, of course.
Real quick. This dude, they shoved it into 2 hours. That's part of why they did not develop Aquaman enough, in my opinion. I wanted to see more Aquaman, more of his ability, more of his giftedness.
You've got to be kidding me. Are you trolling me right now?
No, I'm not trolling you. You don't like Aquaman?
The fish guy, the guy who controls water and talks to fish, you want to spend more time with him?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh. I don't understand you. I'll say this. Jason Momoa is one of the more compelling versions of Aquaman I've ever seen, but Aquaman is a character to me. There's not a lot there with Aquaman. And my sister-in-law, Alexis, if she is listening to this, is boiling mad at me right now. I'm sorry, Alexis. I'm entrenched in the position. Aquaman does not grab my attention. I would rather see much more from Cyborg, Flash, everybody else. Aquaman would be the very last.
Well, I liked, same thing with Cyborg and even the Flash. I think from what I heard, from what I understand, now this may have just been rumor, but Warner Brothers sat down and said, you got to fit in 2 hours.
Yeah, the biggest problem basically with these movies has been the creative minds behind it and the corporate structure in control of it. I don't think Warner Brothers cares for comics. I mean, the entire DC line for them is, you know, one line item that's equivalent to a tax write-off in terms of the bottom line contribution. And then you have Zack Snyder and Jeff Johns, who are people who don't understand, at least in my pretty extensive consumption of their works, they don't understand morality. So they tell these incredibly uncompelling stories about superheroes who are supposed to be morality tales. If you could get some people who loved comic books and sort of understood that moral clarity is compelling and certainly not boring and something to be pushed off, I think you could see these characters take off because they're historically great sellers. Marvel mm-hmm. has done a much better job of that. Now, yeah, a guy like Tony Stark has moral gray areas, but he has grown. You have these moral exemplars like Captain America, the Black Panther. It's no wonder those stories sell better. They're more like reality and mm-hmm. what people want to see in mythological figures.
Yeah, so, good call, man. Good call.
Having said all of that, I'm going to bring us full circle. I really do think this movie deserves more consideration. I think it deserves more consideration from Christians. And I think that if Wonder Woman and Justice League indicate some kind of trajectory for the DCEU, we may see it climb out of the hole it's in among the viewing public. So if your conscience lets you, this one's worth picking up at Redbox and giving a look-see.
Good call.
Jared, where can our listeners find you if they want more content from the mind of Jared Moore?
Oh, my. You can find me on Twitter at Jared H. Moore. You can find me on Facebook at All Truth Is God's Truth. I've actually got another podcast called All Truth Is God's Truth. Check it out. And you can find Jeff and I on Pathos, pathos.com/blogs/popculturecorumdeo, where we're trying to do about an article or two a week where we do companion pieces over the episodes we've interacted with. Check it out.
Yeah, I'm at Right Jeff on most social media platforms. You can find our podcast on most social media platforms as well at PCCDPod. And I mentioned our subreddit a minute ago. It is on reddit.com, obviously, r/PCCDPod. So we would love to connect with you in any way possible. We'd really appreciate some 5-star iTunes reviews or wherever you're listening to this podcast. And any feedback you want to give, we would love to hear it because we want this podcast to be helpful as well as entertaining and engaging in some ways, at least on an intellectual level. So anything you can tell us, even if it's critical in a negative sense, we want to hear it because we want to offer a good service to those who take the time to listen. Jared, I think that's going to wrap it up for this one. I'm not sure what we're going to watch next time. So listeners, stay tuned. We'll be back with another episode very soon. And it'll be a surprise to us what we watch as well, I guess. All right, guys. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of the Pop Culture Corumdale podcast. We will talk to you next time.